All right, get ready because today we're diving into a story that's it's full of twists and turns. It's the story of Naaman. He was a Syrian general, from the Book of Two Kings.
Yeah.
We're gonna go deep on this one.
What's always so fascinating to me about this story is how it really flips the script on power. You have this man, he's the commander of armies, he's got the king's favor,
Right.
and yet he's totally powerless against this debilitating
It really
disease.
makes you think, huh? Like, it's the ultimate irony.
Yeah.
A warrior not taken down by a sword, but by a,
Right.
well, the sources call it leprosy.
Exactly. And it's important to remember that back then, what they called leprosy might not have been the same thing as what we know today,
Okay.
but still it was a condition that carried just a huge weight of social stigma and even religious implications.
So we've got this picture of Naaman, right?
Yeah.
This man who's used to conquering. Now he's forced to confront his vulnerability. I can't even imagine what
Yeah.
that must have done to his ego.
We have to remember the cultural context,
Yeah.
In ancient Syria, being good at the military, it wasn't just about strength.
Yeah.
It was tied to your identity, your favor with the gods.
Wow.
So for Naaman, this wasn't just like a physical thing. It was a blow to who he was at his core.
And it's in this context, right? When he's at his lowest point, that we meet this really remarkable character, this young Israelite girl.
Yes.
She's taken captive and she's forced to serve in Naaman's household.
Yeah, and it's easy to just kind of overlook her, She doesn't even have a name in the text.
It's true.
But what she lacks in social standing, she more than makes up for in faith.
Yeah.
Think about it. She's been taken from her home, her family, everything she knows, yet she still believes that God can heal,
Right.
a God powerful enough to even reach into this what seems like a hopeless situation.
That's what always gets me about her story. I mean, I think it would be so understandable if she was just filled with despair and anger,
Oh, absolutely.
but she chooses hope, and not just like a passive hope. She actually speaks up,
Yeah,
she suggests a solution.
right.
Where do you think that kind of unwavering faith comes from?
It's a question that people have been thinking about for centuries.
Really?
Yeah. Some people point to the long tradition of faith within Israelite culture.
Okay.
They had a history of seeing God's power. But I think there's also something to be said for the strength that you can find when you're completely helpless, like when you have nothing left to lose.
I see.
Maybe it's easier to just totally lean on faith.
It's like she embodies that verse from Proverbs, "When my heart was grieved, I sought the Lord." And her faith doesn't just impact her own life, you know what I mean? It like sets off this chain reaction. It even draws in the highest powers in the land.
Oh, yeah.
We're talking kings, international diplomacy.
This simple act of faith by this young girl really sets in motion all these events that could have so easily turned into conflict.
Because the king of Syria hears about this prophet in Israel, Elisha, and he's like, okay, great. Write a letter to the king of Israel. He'll just order this Elisha guy to heal my general. Easy.
And here's where we see these worldviews clashing. The Syrian king just assumes that earthly power can even control, divine power. He doesn't get that Elisha's authority comes from something totally different.
And the king of Israel, well, let's just say he doesn't handle this well at all.
No, he does not.
He reads the letter, and I mean, he just panics.
Yeah.
He thinks it's a trick to start a war.
Right.
It's almost funny how wrong both these kings are.
It really highlights how limited a purely earthly perspective is.
Yeah.
They're so focused on politics and holding on to their own power that they totally miss what's really going on spiritually. Neither of them even stops to think that maybe Elisha's connection to God is, well, real.
And Elisha, he doesn't exactly go out of his way to make things easy for anyone.
Right.
You'd think he'd like roll out the red carpet for a guy like Naaman, maybe put on some kind of prophetic show,
There
but
you go.
no.
Yeah.
Elisha doesn't even greet him himself.
Instead, he sends a messenger with these really simple, some might even say underwhelming, instructions. Go wash yourself 7 times in the Jordan River.
The Jordan River. Seriously. Why not some sacred spring? Or some ritual with the doves and incense? Why this muddy, totally normal river?
Well, that's where things get really interesting, right?
Yeah.
Because Elisha's instructions are less about the outward show and more about something deeper,
Okay.
something that challenges Naaman's pride.
It's almost like Elisha's saying, if you want to be healed, you've got to let go of your ego, let go of your expectations.
Yes.
You got to humble yourself before something that just seems totally ordinary.
And that's where Naaman's real struggle starts.
Yeah.
Because this request It cuts him deep. He came expecting this huge display of power.
Of course.
Something worthy of his status, you know?
Right.
And instead, he's told to do something that feels, well, beneath him.
I can just imagine him thinking, 7 times
yeah.
in that river. This is a joke, right?
He is outraged. He's offended. But I think under that anger, there's something else.
What's that?
I think he's afraid.
Mm-hmm.
Afraid that maybe everything he's built his life on, his power, his reputation, maybe it doesn't actually mean anything compared to this god that he's meeting.
Wow.
Yeah.
So I guess we'll have to wait till next time to find out what happens.
You'll have to join us for part 2 to see what Naaman decides to do.
Will he let go of his pride and do this simple thing, or will his ego win out?
Exactly.
See you next time.
See you then.
So last time, we left Naaman pretty upset on the banks of the Jordan River. You know, this muddy river is the only thing between him and a possible miracle.
Right.
So did he actually do it? Did he go in?
Well, like a lot of us, when our pride's challenged, Naaman's first instinct is to resist.
Yeah.
He just storms off complaining about how unfair it all is. But here's where the story takes a really interesting turn.
Okay.
His servants, they actually step in.
Ah, the voice of reason.
Exactly. They basically tell him, look, what do you have to lose? Just try it. Go in the river a few times. If it works, amazing. If not, well, you can go back to being angry.
I love it. So smart.
And what I think is so fascinating is they appeal to his logic.
Right.
Not his ego. They say, if the prophet had asked you to do something huge, wouldn't you have done it? So why not try this simple thing?
It's such a good strategy. They totally sidestep Naaman's pride by making the act of obedience seem reasonable, even small.
And it makes you think about the importance of having people around you who can see what you can't. Sometimes we need those wise voices to help us get through our own emotional stuff.
That's so true. So does Naaman listen? Does he actually take the plunge?
He does. And the result is seriously miraculous.
Come on, really?
Yeah. After the 7th time he goes into the Jordan, his skin is totally healed. It's like he's a new man when he comes out of the water. Physically and spiritually.
It gets me every time, you know? This proud, powerful general brought down to this almost childlike act of faith. And in that surrender, he finds healing. It's like the river washes away his disease and his arrogance all at once.
Exactly. And you notice how the story emphasizes the repetition. 7 times in the river. It's not instant, you know? There's a process there, a gradual stripping away of those layers of pride and resistance.
It's almost like a baptism, isn't it? A death and rebirth, not just of the body, but of the spirit, too.
I love that. That's a beautiful thought. And I think Naaman's own words back that up. After he's healed, he says that Yahweh is the one true God. That's a big statement for a man who was probably surrounded by Syrian gods before this.
Yeah, it's a complete change in how he sees the world. He goes from thinking he's this great guy who deserves special treatment to recognizing a power much bigger than him, a power that requires humility and obedience.
And his transformation doesn't end there. He's overwhelmed with gratitude. So he rushes back to Elisha, offering him all these extravagant gifts.
Okay.
And this is where we see how awesome Elisha's character is.
Yeah.
He turns down the gifts. Not even a polite, oh, you're too kind. He actually swears he won't take them. Which, I'll admit, seemed a little harsh to me at first.
I can see that.
It's definitely a strong move, but it helps us understand the role of a prophet back then. Elisha isn't doing magic tricks to get rich. He's a connection to God's power, and that power isn't for sale.
It's like a powerful message about what real faith is all about. It's not about getting something, it's about a relationship.
It really connects to this bigger theological idea about God's sovereignty. Elisha's basically saying that he gets what he needs from God, not from people being generous.
That makes sense. It makes you think about where we put our trust, doesn't it? Are we trying to get stuff here on earth, or are we looking for something more?
Definitely something to think about. Now, Naaman, he's still processing all this. He's had this huge experience with the divine, but he's still got one foot in his old life, you know? Mm-hmm. And then he asks Elisha for something kind of strange. 2 mule loads of dirt from Israel.
Wait, really?
I know, right? Seems weird at first. But I think it shows how much Naaman wants to take a piece of this sacred experience back home with him.
Huh.
A physical reminder of the God he now knows.
Like a souvenir, but with spiritual meaning. A little piece of the ground where he met God.
Exactly. And there's something else on his mind. He's wrestling with this problem. He knows when he goes back to Syria, he'll still have to go to the temple of Rimmon with the king. Rimmon's the Syrian god.
Oh, right.
And so he asks Elisha for forgiveness. He knows this is a conflict between his new faith and his old duties.
He's trying to figure out how to live with this new faith in a place that doesn't get it.
Right.
It's something a lot of people struggle with, I think.
Oh, yeah.
How do you balance what you believe with what your culture, your family, your job expects from you?
It's tough. And Elisha's answer to Naaman's problem is so wise, I think. Yeah. He just tells him to go in peace.
He doesn't give him some hard and fast rule or try to find a theological loophole. Just this simple, powerful blessing.
It shows how complicated faith journeys are. There's no one answer that fits everyone. It's all about growing, wrestling with questions, figuring out those gray areas with humility and grace.
I like that.
And sometimes all we can do is give each other that same peace, that same space to work things out.
You know, that idea of going in peace really sticks with me.
Yeah.
It's like Elisha knows that faith isn't always about having everything figured out.
Right.
It's about trusting even when things are messy, you know?
Exactly. And it's a good reminder that we don't have to have all the answers to be on the right track.
Right.
Naaman's story is just full of these moments of grace.
It is.
These unexpected encounters that lead to huge transformation.
Yeah, it all started with that young girl, you know,
yeah.
The one taken captive who still believed in a God who could heal.
Powerful stuff.
Her simple act of faith started this whole chain reaction.
It did.
Brought down kings and prophets and even Naaman's own pride. And through it all, we see this theme over and over. Earthly power has its limits, but divine power, it works in ways we don't expect.
Makes you think.
Right. It does.
How often are we holding ourselves back because we're stuck on how we think things should be? How many miracles do we miss because we're looking for the big show, some voice from heaven?
Yeah.
When God is actually working in the quiet, ordinary moments.
Like that muddy Jordan River. Mm-hmm. Who knew that just washing could be so powerful? But that's faith, right?
Yeah.
It asks us to step out of our comfort zones.
To
let go of our ideas and be open to something bigger than us.
And sometimes that letting go looks like taking a dip in a river 7 times.
I like that.
Other times, there might be speaking up for what you believe in, even when you're scared. Or maybe it's just choosing to have hope when things feel hopeless, like that young girl did.
So as we wrap up this deep dive into Naaman's story, I want to leave you with this. What ordinary things in your life could actually be amazing if you had a little more humility, a little more faith?
What challenges seem impossible, but could actually change if you believed in a power bigger than yourself?
Maybe there's a miracle waiting for you, right where you least expect it.
That's the beauty of it.
That's why we deep dive.
Absolutely.
Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, everyone.